ever feel like you're drowning in information. You want to get a grasp on the big ideas, the stuff that really matters, but there's just so much out there.
It can be overwhelming for sure.
Right. So that's what we're doing here, taking a deep dive into some really fascinating shifts in religious thought during the 19th and 20th centuries.
A pretty big topic.
It is. We've got this lecture transcript we're going to dig into.
Okay.
We're focusing mainly on some key things going on within Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rise of, well, you could call him a giant, really.
Okay.
A really important Protestant theologian. And we're going to distill it down, pull out the really important insights so you don't have to wade through it all yourself.
All right. Sounds good. This lecture is, well, there's a lot to unpack. I mean, on the one hand, you have this stark contrast within Catholicism in how they approached the modern world. And then, you know, just the way history kind of crashed into this one Protestant thinker's life and really shaped his whole theology.
Yeah, it's almost like two different stories in a way. But both super relevant, I think, to understanding where we are today.
Absolutely.
So let's start with 19th century Catholicism. One thing that immediately jumped out, at least to me, was the difference between Pius IX and Leo XIII. These two popes, I mean, it's almost like they were pulling the church in completely opposite directions.
Yeah. It's a fascinating comparison, isn't it? You can almost picture Pius IX, you know, closing the curtain.
Closing the curtains.
Yeah, metaphorically. He had this suspicion of the modern world, of what was going on outside. Like, Christianity, as it had been known, was under attack. So he focused on strengthening papal authority, creating a more distinct Catholic identity.
This is Ultramontanism, right?
Exactly. Ultramontanism, that's the term for it. It was all about centralizing authority, you know, creating a kind of fortress around the Catholic faith.
So it's closing the curtains, and then you have Leo III, who comes along later, facing some of the same issues, but...
He throws open the windows. He says, you know, the church needs to engage with the world. If we want to be relevant, we can't just shut ourselves off. It's a totally different way of looking at things. And it really highlights the tension within the church at the time.
I see. So he's not afraid of the modern world. He wants to go out and meet it.
Yeah, you could say that.
And that kind of leads us to Rerum Novarum, which feels like a major turning point.
It was huge. Rerum Novarum, new things. As it translates to, it was a real landmark. What's so important are the stances it takes. You know, it really shows the church becoming aware of these social issues.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, the first thing is that it comes out strongly in support of laborers. It says they deserve fair wages, just treatment. I mean, think about the working conditions back then.
Yeah, pretty brutal.
It was really tough. So the church is making a statement here, saying these people matter.
Wow. That's pretty radical, especially back then.
It was a big deal. It really marked this, you know, I guess you could say a turning point for the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of social justice, it's moving away from this image of being aligned with the upper classes and towards being on the side of the working class.
So Rerum Novarum was a huge step, huh?
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay, so we've got the church standing up for workers. What else?
The second key point is that it supports social legislation. Things like... limits on working hours, safer working conditions, things like that.
Okay. So it's not just words.
No.
Yeah.
It's about concrete action, showing that the church cares about the everyday lives of people. And then the third thing, and this was, well, this was quite controversial at the time.
What's that?
It endorses trade unions.
Wow. I bet that didn't go over well everywhere.
No, it didn't. I mean, back then, workers were really struggling just to organize. And for the church to say, hey, we support this, that was a big deal. It really shows a shift, a move towards standing with the working class. You know, the lecture even mentions how, like, the French Revolution, part of that was rooted in this feeling that the church was too close to the aristocracy.
Interesting. So Rerum Novarum is a real departure from that.
Yeah, you could say that's a new era for the church in a lot of ways. So alongside all this, you also have some significant developments in terms of Catholic doctrine during the 19th century.
Right. And one of the first that comes to mind is the Immaculate Conception.
Yes.
Declared in 1854.
By Pius IX.
Right, by Pius IX. Now, I think this is something that a lot of people, especially those who aren't Catholic, get confused about.
Yeah, it's easy to misunderstand. But... the lecture makes a really important point right off the bat.
Yeah.
The Immaculate Conception is not the same thing as the virgin birth.
Okay, good to clarify that. So what exactly is it then?
Okay, so it's the belief that Mary, from the very moment of her conception was preserved from original sin.
From the moment she was conceived.
Yes, through God's grace.
I see. So Mary's parents conceived her in the normal way.
Exactly.
But she herself was kept free from original sin.
Right. And that she remained sinless throughout her entire life. It's a complex doctrine, but it really served to, well, had a couple of purposes, you could say.
What were those?
Well, firstly, Pius IX. He saw the Christian world kind of under attack at that time.
Okay.
So he wanted to emphasize Mary, this pure figure, to kind of rally the faithful, strengthen their devotion to the church.
Okay, so it's a way to bring people together.
Exactly.
And secondly?
Secondly, there were challenges to Christ's divinity in the 19th century.
Interesting. So how does this relate to that?
Well, if Mary is sinless, then Jesus, who inherited his human nature from her, would also be free from original sin. It reinforces his unique status.
Okay, I see. It's about preserving that pure lineage.
You could put it that way. Mm. And the lecture makes the point that this state of innocence, justice, and sanctity was given to Mary at her conception.
But she was still human, right?
Oh, absolutely. She still experienced sorrow, sickness, eventually death. It wasn't that she was immune to the normal human condition.
Good point.
And while 1854 is when it was formally declared doctrine, the idea of Mary's sinlessness, that goes way back. There's this concept of Mary as the new Eve. You know, she kind of reverses Eve's disobedience through her own obedience. That was already present in the early church.
Interesting. So it's not like this completely new idea that just popped up.
Right. Though it's worth noting that even figures like Augustine, he had some questions about it.
Really?
Yeah, back in the day.
Yeah.
But over the centuries, the understanding kind of developed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even in the medieval period, they had a feast day for the conception of Mary.
So it was a gradual process.
Yeah, you could say that. And of course, there were concerns when Pius IX declared it.
Like what?
Well, some worried that it would create more division between Catholics and Protestants.
Right, because Protestants generally look for explicit biblical support for those kinds of beliefs.
That's a key difference in how they approach tradition and doctrine. And that actually takes us to the next Marian doctrine, the Assumption of Mary. This one jumps ahead a bit to 1950.
Okay, a big leap in time. But I guess it makes sense to talk about them together.
Yeah, the lecture presents it as kind of a natural continuation.
So what exactly is the assumption?
Well, it's the belief that Mary, when she finished her earthly life, was taken up body and soul into heaven.
Okay. And the implication is that she didn't go through purgatory.
That's right. She was welcomed straight into heaven.
Wow. The lecture mentions the Church of the Dormition in Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's traditionally associated with the event.
Okay. It's interesting. The lecturer briefly talked about how there seems to be more interest in Mary these days, even outside of Catholicism, but also mentioned some of their own, you know, theological questions about how far some traditions go with Marian devotion.
Yeah, it definitely highlights how different Christian groups view her in quite different ways.
Okay, so we've got these Marian doctrines, and then there's this other big one in the 19th century. Papal infallibility.
Right. 1870, the First Vatican Council. And this is another one where people often get the wrong idea, especially if they're not Catholic.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people imagine the Pope as like this superhero who can never make a mistake.
Yeah, not quite. The lecture really stressed that it's not about the Pope being perfect in his personal life or anything like that.
Right. So what is it about?
It's specifically about pronouncements on matters of faith and morals.
Okay. And it only applies in very specific circumstances, right?
Right. It's only when the Pope speaks ex cathedra.
Ex cathedra.
It means from the chair.
From the chair.
Yes, like, you know, his official chair. In the cathedral. The cathedra is the bishop's official seat. And speaking from the chair means he's speaking in his role as the supreme teacher of the church.
Oh, I see. So it's a formal declaration, not just something he says casually.
Exactly. And even then, it's only on matters of doctrine. And, you know, since 1870... only one doctrine has been proclaimed ex cathedra.
Really? Just one?
Yeah, the Assumption of Mary. So it shows how rarely this actually happens. The lecture went into some of the theological arguments behind it.
Oh, yeah. What were those?
Well, one is based on the idea that the Holy Spirit guides the church. So the Pope, as the leader of the church, he's guided by the Holy Spirit to teach correctly.
Yeah.
Prevents the whole church from falling into error.
Okay, I see. And what's the other argument?
The other one has to do with the salvation of souls. It says, you know, people need clear guidance to live according to God's will. And the Pope provides that.
So it's like a safeguard.
Yeah, you could say that. And the Catholic Church, they often point to Matthew 16.
Matthew 16.
Yeah, the passage about Peter, where Jesus says, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church."
Oh, yeah, I know that one. But I think Catholics and Protestants interpret it quite differently.
They do. Catholics see it as establishing Peter as the first pope and giving him and his successors this unique authority.
But Protestants, they tend to see the rock as Peter's confession of faith.
Right. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God.
Yeah.
So it's not about a specific person, but about that belief. It really shows how the same text can be understood in totally different ways.
It really does. And of course, Protestants often emphasize the Bible as the ultimate authority.
Right. Whereas Catholicism places more emphasis on tradition as well.
And one last point about papal infallibility.
Yeah.
The lecture mentioned that when a pope does speak ex cathedra, it's not just his own opinion. It's meant to reflect what the church as a whole has always believed.
Absolutely. It's a formal articulation of the existing faith of the church.
So looking back, it's clear that the 19th century was a period of, well, it seems like a lot of internal change for Catholicism.
Yeah, between the different approaches to modernity and then these doctrinal pronouncements.
Exactly. And I think it sets the stage for what we're going to talk about next, the shift to the Protestant world in the 20th century.
Right. And our focus on Karl Barth.
Yeah. A towering figure in Protestant theology. But to really understand him, we have to understand the context he was coming from.
Absolutely. So we start with his biography. He was born in Bern, Switzerland in 1886.
Yeah.
And it's important to remember he was Swiss. It'll become really important later.
Right. And the lecture mentions he studied at several German universities.
That was pretty common back then. You know, students would go to specific universities to study under certain professors.
So it was about finding the right teacher.
Yeah.
And then he becomes a pastor.
Right. First in Geneva for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then in this small Swiss village called Seyfenwil.
Seyfenwil.
Yeah, from 1911 to 1921. It seems like he thought he'd spend his life there, you know, just being a pastor in this quiet little village.
But then World War I happens.
Yeah, 1914. It changes everything, not just for the world, but for Barth personally.
And theologically, right.
Absolutely. The horrors of the war, they just shattered the old ways of thinking.
Mm.
Barth had been trained in this classical Protestant liberalism,
yeah.
You know, guys like Schleiermacher.
Right.
But it all just felt so inadequate, so out of touch with the reality of sin and evil that the war had exposed.
Like their nice liberal theology couldn't handle the brutality of what was happening.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it leads Barth to a really deep engagement with the Bible, especially Romans.
Romans?
Yeah, around 1919. He writes this commentary on Romans,
mm-hmm.
and it's a bomb. It totally challenges the prevailing liberal theology.
Wow. The lecture compares it to Calvin and Wesley's encounters with Romans. Like, this book has this power to just shake things up.
It's incredible. And what really resonated was Barth's emphasis on the difference between God and humanity. This radical separation, mm-hmm. you know, this holy God, and then sinful humanity. Especially after the war, this idea that we can bridge that gap ourselves through reason or progress,
mm-hmm.
it just felt hollow.
Yeah, I can see how that would hit home.
It had a huge impact.
Yeah.
So in 1921, Barth moves from being a pastor to teaching in a university.
Okay.
He ends up as a professor at Bonn in 1930.
Bonn, Germany.
Yeah.
Seems like a natural progression. But then Hitler comes to power.
1933, the Nazi regime. And this is where his Swiss citizenship becomes crucial.
Right. You said that was important.
It really was. The lecture points out a few things. First, as a Swiss citizen, he had more freedom.
Freedom to do what?
To speak out. You know, he had more protections than German citizens under the Nazis.
Makes sense. What else?
Second, initially, his political stance was one of neutrality.
Neutrality?
Yeah, he thought the church should stay out of politics.
Interesting. But I guess that didn't last long.
No. As the Nazis showed their true colors, he realized that wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
He saw Hitler as an illegitimate ruler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone who had abused his power. And that changed his whole view of the church's role in relation to politics.
Okay. And the third point.
This is a big one. He helps write the Barman Declaration in 1934.
Barman Declaration.
Yeah, it was this statement from the Confessing Church.
Confessing Church.
It was this underground Protestant movement that resisted the Nazis.
Oh, no, I didn't know about that.
Yeah. And the Barman Declaration was basically saying, we stand for the true gospel. We reject Nazi ideology.
Mm-hmm.
Barth was a key figure in that. And then the fourth thing.
Yeah.
He refuses to swear an oath to Hitler.
Oh.
He gets him kicked out of Bonn. But because he's Swiss, he's not arrested or anything.
Thank goodness for that Swiss passport.
Right. It literally saved him. You know, his student, Bonhoeffer, he wasn't so lucky.
Right. a much more tragic story. So Barth is expelled from Germany, and he goes back to Switzerland.
Yeah, he ends up as a professor at Basel.
Basel.
Yeah, in Switzerland. And he becomes this internationally known figure. He even ends up on the cover of Time magazine.
Wow. That's pretty amazing for a theologian.
It is. And the lecture talked about the image on the cover. It's him with an empty tomb behind him.
That's a powerful image.
It was. A real contrast to the liberal Protestantism that had become so focused on humanity.
And it's in this later period that he starts his magnum opus, Church Dogmatics.
This massive theological work.
Yeah, he started it in 32 and kept working on it until he died.
The lecturer mentioned he actually died while writing.
Really?
Yeah. Pictures of Calvin and Mozart in his study. And his wife, Nellie, she had been with him through it all.
Wow. And Church Dogmatics is huge, right?
It's massive. The original title was just Christian Dogmatics, but he changed it to emphasize that it was for the church.
I see.
You know, this Protestant idea of constantly reinterpreting theology for a new generation.
Right.
Like Luther and Calvin did.
Right.
And the scale of it, the lecturer said he wrote like 1,800 pages just on the doctrine of reconciliation.
1,800 pages?
Two whole volumes. People call him the second Augustine. I mean, he really was the great theologian of the 20th century. Yeah. He pushed back against liberalism and shaped Protestant thought for years to come.
It's incredible. So we've covered a lot of ground here. Looking back, we've seen these big shifts in 19th century Catholicism.
Yeah.
Pius IX versus Leo III.
Mm-hmm.
These Marian doctrines, papal infallibility.
All against the backdrop of modernity.
Right. And then we move to the 20th century. We see Karl Barth grappling with war and the rise of Nazism. It shows how theology is always intertwined with what's happening in the world.
It's never just an abstract thing.
No. So as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a question. You know, Pius IX tried to shield the church from the modern world. Leo XIII embraced it. Karl Barth was shaped by historical events. How do you think the changes happening today are affecting religious thought?
What curtains are being drawn? What are being opened? It's a question worth thinking about.
It really is. And if you're interested in learning more, you know, check out some of Leo III's writings or maybe some of Barth's early work.
There's a lot more to explore. This was just a glimpse into a really fascinating period in religious history.
Thanks for joining us for another deep dive. We'll see you next time.
See you then.